The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Shantideva's chapter on wisdom, Prajna. It is suffering and its causes that need to be abandoned, and it is the delusion of self-grasping that causes delusions and suffering to increase. But the questioner says, but there is no way to abandon self-grasping so that it will never recur. Shantideva says, on the contrary, meditation on selflessness or emptiness is the supreme method for accomplishing this. In the teachings of the Paramitas, it is wisdom that makes the other Paramitas perfections of the Bodhisattva, that makes them practices of crossing over. And in a way, it's much easier to understand dana, giving, patience, effort, meditation, the moral teachings. Although each of those has a depth of understanding that I hope all of us will spend our lives plumbing the depths of. From the very beginning, a beginning practitioner can have a reasonably good sense of what each of those are and begin to practice them, and then realize while they may be somewhat easier to understand, they are not easy to practice. They're actually very challenging. Wisdom is much more difficult to understand because by its very nature, it doesn't lend itself, it doesn't, in a sense, yield to explanation, to instruction, to descriptions, because by definition, it is not of that realm. It cannot be spoken of. And so the ways throughout the history of Buddhism, the teachings have spoken about, tried to bring forth the understanding, the teachings around about wisdom are many. And so here in this chapter, Shantideva is devoting a considerable amount of teaching to this subject and goes and addresses it in a number of different ways. But as in this passage that I read, it is dukkha, and remember that dukkha, suffering, is not just suffering in the way that we normally understand it. It includes that, but it's also just a deep, pervasive, and sort of consistent, really predictable experience of disappointment and dissatisfaction with anything that we attach to or anything that we try to avoid. And that is this delusion of grasping to the self, of self-grasping, that causes our delusions and dukkha to increase. So the more we grasp, the more dukkha increases. This is why when we begin practicing and are practicing well and sincerely, we can observe dukkha beginning to decrease. It's not as strong and pervasive and overwhelming and dominating and so on. We can actually observe that it's shifting. And fundamentally, it's because the grasping to the self is changing, is decreasing. But then the questioner says, but there's no way to abandon self-grasping so that it will never occur. And it can seem like that, right? It can seem like it's always going to be there, and we just have to sort of accept that and do the best we can and, you know, mitigate the damage and, you know, sort of manage it. And Shantideva would say, no, on the contrary. Meditating on selflessness or emptiness, the same, is the great method for accomplishing this. And of course, he's saying this within the context of the teachings of the Paramitas, which includes not just meditating on selflessness, but practicing dana and joyful effort and patience and the precepts and doing meditation. And so the Eightfold Path, the Bodhisattva Path, Eight Gates, Ango, Seshin, all of these different ways of practicing, of training, that have come down to us, are directed to exactly this. Suffering and its causes abandoned, compassion and its causes being cultivated. And so Shantideva says, in terms of, well, what is this selflessness? And so he says, neither the mind of the past nor the mind of the future is the self. So the other day I talked about how the body, we relate, identify with the body as a self, or feelings, karma, or mind. So here he's speaking again to the mind. So past mind cannot be the self, it's gone. Future mind cannot be the self, doesn't exist. It's an idea. Because the former has ceased and the latter has yet to be produced. But the questioner says, but surely the mind arising in the present moment is the self. Shantideva says, well, if that were so, then the self would not exist in the next moment. Because it's the present moment self, which is means permanent, because that's the questioner is basically saying, but surely the mind exists and is the self in a permanent kind of way in the present moment. And Shantideva says, well, then it would only exist in the present moment and not in the next moment. Or if it existed in every present moment, then you would have 4 quadrillion selves piling up, right? Sometimes I guess that's what it seems like. He says, if you peel away the layers of the trunk of a plantain tree, you will never discover anything substantial. So this is an example that's used. Plantain tree has no core, no hardwood. In the same way, if you conduct an analysis, an examination, you'll never be able to find a self or an I. Then the questioner says, but if living beings have no true existence, for whom do we develop compassion? Now, this is a question that goes all the way back to the Buddha, not so much in terms of compassion, but in terms of if there is no self, then isn't that nihilism, right? Then what you're saying is nothing exists and nothing matters and there's no point to anything. And so what are we doing? And so since the time of the Buddha, that critique, that criticism, that misunderstanding has been brought to Buddhists, Buddhist practitioners, Buddhist teachers, and constantly and persistently rejected as a misunderstanding of the teachings, of the understanding of emptiness. So here it is again, if living beings have no true existence, for whom are we developing compassion? If there is no self, then for whom am I trying to alleviate suffering if there's no self? And Shantideva says, we promise to achieve the goal of Buddhahood for the sake of those whom ignorance, delusion, imputes as truly existent. So we vow to alleviate the suffering of all beings who believe in the self as something that exists, that is solid, that is fixed, that is permanent, and because of that, cycle within samsara. And then the questioner says, but if living beings don't truly exist, are empty, who will gain the results of meditating on compassion? So if the bodhisattva is developing merit, by developing compassion, bringing forth, invoking compassion, alleviating the suffering of others, then they're not gaining the merit of that, right? That's not helping them transform their lives. Shantideva says, it is true that the cause, meditation on compassion, like the Four Immeasurables, and the result, Buddhahood, and the Four Immeasurables is taught from the very beginning as a path to realizing Buddhahood, a meditation. He says, although it's true that both of those don't truly exist, don't exist in any fundamental, separate, and distinct way, but they do exist conventionally. Thus, so that the suffering of all living beings may be completely freed and liberated, we should not reject the conventionally existent compassion which leads to that result. And of course, this is talking about the Two Truths teaching. So to counteract the tendency to, in a sense, overextend or overreach, if you will, the understanding of emptiness into nihilism, nothing exists, holding up the conventional, the relative, the ordinary experience we have of things that we see and relate to every day, that those are both held up as truths. They're both true. They both have their own truth. Nagarjuna said, there is something that is appearing before you. Don't negate that. Don't deny that. But what is the nature of its existence? How does it exist? That's what Buddhist practice is investigating. Because it's in that inquiry, or the lack of, when we don't understand, then things seem to just exist by themselves, have their own power. And so when you say something and I get angry, you did that to me, right? Or I believe in something in an absolute sense, this is an absolute truth, then I might fight and die and kill for that because it's an absolute truth that exists in and of itself. Or that I impute into anyone a characteristic, true or false, and make that their identity, that's who they are, then that can very easily lead to, I mean, it almost inevitably leads to not seeing them as they are, not seeing them as a human being, not seeing all that they are, solidifying something, a characteristic that may or may not be true, and not seeing it as a characteristic or an action, but seeing it as their very person, right? Which again becomes the basis for hatred, anger, violence, oppression. And so the implications, what the Buddha realized, the implications of the sense of a self and the belief in that, the delusion of that and the attachment to that, is at the heart of every single act in the human world that causes unhappiness. Every one. And so there are different ways to understand the emptiness of the self. The other night I talked about another section in Shantideva where he talked about, well, you can't find the self in your leg or your foot or your arm or your shoulder and so on, going through this sort of examination, right, which can be done just sort of reflectively as a reflection. It can be done as a direct meditation. You know, and Dogen speaks about this. Because sometimes the way that's presented is it presents the sense of a self. Okay, so investigate that. How large is it? Is it square? Is it round? Is it soft? Is it hard? Is it light? Is it dark? Does it exist in your abdomen, in your heart, in your head? It asks very specific questions that are actually directed at a meditation inquiry. Dogen does the same thing in some of his fascicles. He doesn't say, okay, now here's a meditation practice. He just, as he does, and as often happens in the Zen style of teaching, he just integrates it within a teaching. He might be talking about emptiness. He might be talking about Buddha nature. He might be talking about the self. And then he'll ask a series of questions. Is it blue? Is it yellow? Is it red? Is it yesterday? Is it tomorrow? Is it inside or outside? It's the same thing. It's the same. It's clear that he encountered those same teachings, right, that are part integral part of Buddhist tradition and was presenting them. And I'm sure presented that not just, you know, as an idle paragraph in his teaching, but with the expectation that his students would then take that up and engage it as a meditation. So that's one way. Nagarjuna said, study the self in terms of dependent arising. So if everything is a result of karmic actions and conditions being, in essence, your consciousness that is associated with each sense organ, your sense organ and the object, that because we can't have any perception without those three coming together, nothing exists for us objectively by itself. Nothing exists by itself autonomously. Everything is perceived and experienced as a result of dependent arising. Nagarjuna said that's the same as it's being empty. It is empty of its own existence. How does it exist? In a sense of dependent mutuality. It can be thought of and it can be looked at in terms of impermanence. If things were self-existing, they wouldn't be impermanent. They'd be permanent because they wouldn't be subject to change. So impermanence, which we all experience, witness, is an expression, a kind of manifestation, you might say, of emptiness. And so the impermanence of the self, I was just listening to a talk where the teacher said, I'd never heard this before, but he said it's a traditional way of speaking about it, that you're on a ship and you're setting out for a very long voyage. And because it's so long, you have enough lumber to replace the wood as it rots, right? Because it's a long trip. So every time a plank of wood or a piece of wood rots, you take it out, toss it, I guess, and you take a new piece of lumber and you replace it. By the time you've gotten to your destination, every single plank has been replaced. Is it the same boat or not? So these are all different ways of trying to examine, even just hold in our mind, how can the self be empty? Because it just seems like how could any of this be happening if there's not a me, if there's not something that is fixed? I talked about this the other day in terms of the continuum of consciousness being mistaken for an abiding self. The Majjhimagga teachings say all the sutras teach emptiness as set forth by the Buddha to counteract or liberate us from the mental afflictions. They do not diminish this fear. They don't negate the afflictions. They don't oppose, they don't deny, but rather they are to liberate. It goes on to say, the purpose of the sutras that teach emptiness, that is the absence of inherent existence, is to eliminate mental afflictions by seeing that they have no fixedness. Those sutras, however, do not teach that the sphere of natural purity does not exist, that is, the world that we live in. Those who think that way approach the meaning of the scriptures incorrectly. The Buddha said, this ultimate truth is unique. It is nirvana, that which is non-deceptive. All compounded things, all things that arise as a result of causing conditions, have the quality of being seen or have the capacity to be seen as false and deceptive. That they seem to be deceiving us. They're not deceiving us. But our senses, basically, are misunderstanding what we're seeing. And so we can think of practice as working towards no longer being deceived by our senses, by our memories, by our habits and ideas, by the emotions that arise. So when something arises that seems so powerful, so strong, a memory, an awareness, an emotion, a thought, a judgment, and it begins to take over. It builds and it builds and we get drawn in, right? And it proliferates and it escalates. That's what the Buddha says in that moment. He's speaking about a deception. We're not seeing something clearly. And of course, this kind of deception, it's not intentional. We're not trying to deceive ourselves. Actually, we're trying to do just the opposite. So it's not an intentional. It's not like I'm trying to deceive you so I can get something. It's not like that. And so Shantideva says, so the meditation on selflessness is the supreme method. Now in the Vimalakirti Sutra, so this question that is raised, if this is so, this selflessness, then how do we make sense of compassion? In the Vimalakirti Sutra, Manjushri asks Vimalakirti, how should a bodhisattva regard all living beings? Right? How are we, so here's one, here's a bunch of them, right, appearing before me. So you do exist, but what is the nature of your existence? How do you exist? How should I see you? So that I'm not deceiving myself and acting on that in a way that is not skillful, helpful, hurtful. So Vimalakirti said, Manjushri, a bodhisattva should regard all living beings as a wise person regards the reflections of the moon in water. Something is there, but it's not the moon. Or as a magician regards figures created by magic. There's an illusory quality. We get drawn in. One should regard them as being like a face in a mirror. You stand before a mirror, your face is there, but it's not your face, it's a reflection. Like the water of a mirage, like the sound of an echo, like a mass of clouds in the sky, like the appearance and disappearance of a bubble of water, like a flash of lightning. So these are all things that clearly are impermanent, fleeting, ephemeral. If you try to hold on to them, you can't. But something's there. And actually, some of these you can use. You can use a face in the mirror. We do it all the time. Right? So they're not harmful in and of themselves. They're just arising out of their own, you could say, causing conditions. It's our perception of them is where we get a little whacked out. So then he goes on to say, so these are things that arise that are ephemeral, fleeting, a flash of lightning. But then he goes on in a different way. He says, how should we regard living beings? He says, like the fifth great element. There is no fifth great element. Like the seventh sense medium. There are only six senses. Like a sprout from a rotten seed. A rotten seed doesn't bring forth a sprout. Like a tortoise with a coat of hair. Okay. Like fire burning without fuel. He actually goes on with a whole long list. So here he's drawing on things that don't actually exist at all. But we could imagine them. He's just invoked them. And as he invokes a tortoise with a coat of hair, right? I see that. I could write a story about it. I could try and convince you that I've actually seen one. They exist. Right? And so I guess now with internet and AI, I could, you know, I don't know, make it the CEO of a company or something. So he's drawn on different ways of seeing a living being. So as something that actually doesn't exist, we can invoke it, we can describe it, we can write songs about it, we can do all kinds of things, but actually when we look carefully, we can't find it. So then Manjushri asks this question, which if we, you know, if we're reflecting, has got to come around. And he says, well, sir, if a bodhisattva considers all living beings in this way, then how do they generate the great love towards them? How do they generate compassion if they themselves are empty? If the person that is suffering is empty, if their suffering itself is empty, if anything I do to try and alleviate their suffering is empty, then what gives, right? How would I actually even do that? And Manjushri Vimalakirti says, when a bodhisattva considers all living beings in this way, they think, just as I have realized the Dharma, so should I teach it to living beings. And thereby they generate the great love, which is a refuge for all living beings. So in this way, he responds by saying, because you yourself have seen through that illusion, because you have practiced and watched that self-clinging drop away, begin to lessen, and seen the effects of that, there's a direct causal relationship. It's based in evidence. Buddhism is not theoretical. Faith is very important, but faith helps us to come in and trust and practice in such a way that it becomes verified. This is an essential principle of Buddhism. And so because you have experienced those changes, you have seen for yourself that it is possible to alleviate your suffering. And all that goes into creating them and all that can go into cultivating, alleviating your own unhappiness and anger and selfishness and so on, you know that it's possible for that to be done, for that to occur for other people. You just know it. Not because you have faith in it, not because it's a good idea to have, not because it feels good to have it, but you know, because you know that you are in essence the same as anyone else. You have human consciousness, you have a human body, you have human senses. When we, you know, in our ordinary lives, when we, from within a sense of self, we aspire towards something, we apply our effort, we accomplish something, we care about something, we believe in something, we face challenges, we persevere. Generally speaking, there is self-concern, right? There is some self-grasping. There's something in it for me. A reward, a sense of purpose, a sense of fulfillment. And we can assume that if that wasn't there, then I wouldn't be motivated to do that. And that's not at all uncommon. I mean, I hear that a lot from people. If I didn't care about something, if I wasn't attached to the outcome, then what would motivate me? Or sometimes if I wasn't upset about this, or if I wasn't angry about this, then I wouldn't be motivated to do anything about it. It's my anger that's motivating. And anger can be a motivation. When somebody asked the Dalai Lama that question about anger, he said, yes, it can motivate people to work for the good of something. He said, but it has a blinding quality to it. And so even though it may help us to motivate us, at the same time it's blinding us because of the power of that anger. And I always feel like it also kinds of sells ourselves short. Like, really? Like if I'm not attached, if I'm not angry, I won't care? I just don't think that's true. So how do we generate the great love? Vimalakirti says, just as you have seen what is possible, so you know that is possible for others. What would be the motivation without a self? Well, what motivates you to bathe, to eat, to sleep, to brush your teeth? You might think, well, if I don't, you know, it's going to get a little, you know, something, a little funky. But actually to take care of oneself, to keep oneself healthy, feels good, right? Feels good. I mean, think about when we really don't feel good, sometimes those are the things that drop away. It's harder to take care of ourselves because we don't feel good. And so we don't do those things that actually make us, can help us to feel good. There's something that is self-affirming about that. I mean, think about animals, grooming. So I have this cat, Sophie, wonderful, beautiful cat, who will not let us touch her. She's feral. She's, something happened. You know, it was interesting. She jumped up on the chair when I came home the other night before I went to bed, and she was right there, right there. And anytime I moved my hand, she was watching my hands, right? But so I sort of put my hands away, and then I looked at her, and I started to go close to her, and she started to go close to me, and I thought, ah, it's the hands. She's scared of the hands. So I haven't quite figured out how I'm going to just use my face to bridge that gap, but I'm working on it. But I watch her, because she won't let us touch her. And then we keep saying, Sophie, this would feel so good if you'd let us do this. Right? Yumi knows it. But she grooms herself. And we can see that not only is she keeping herself clean, but it soothes her. It feels good. In some way, I believe it makes her feel good about herself. Right? Do we need a self to do that? Right? When the self is realized as empty, when we practice selflessness, letting go of self-grasping, it feels good. It feels better. Even when it's difficult, it's not the same difficulty. Just having a path is different than not having a path. Being lost and confused, not knowing what to do next or how to meet this situation when you really don't have anything to rely upon other than whatever's on the market, versus you actually have a path, you can take refuge. You can take refuge. And you have developed a sense of what that actually is and what that means and what you can do. That, then, we can hold our uncertainty, our confusion, our strong emotions. So Vimalakirti says, what is this great love, the selfless compassion that we generate towards self and others? Vimalakirti says, it is the love. And in the footnote to this translation by Robert Thurman, he has a footnote to that first use of the word love. And he says, because this was published quite a while ago. In fact, he used to be sort of friends with Dada Roshi. And so that was the way we could get him to come and lead retreats. And it was great having him here lead retreats. You just sort of sit back, put on your seatbelt, right? Because you have no idea where you're going. I remember when he came into the retreat on Vimalakirti, and we were up in cabin 10. And he talked for the longest time about the very opening where the Buddha puts his toe, his big toe, on the ground. And he just went off on the big toe. But in his translation, he references that use of the word love, and he said, up to that point, scholars and translators were very cautious about using that word for compassion because of all of its sort of packed meanings in the West, right? And he says, but it is the purest form of love, a selfless love, right? And so it is an appropriate word if we understand it in that way. And so Vimalakirti said, you generate the love that is peaceful because it's not grasping. Peaceful because it's not grasping. Right? As soon as it becomes grasping, we know if we're on the receiving end of that, suddenly it doesn't quite feel like love. It starts to feel like something else. Non-grasping. That's also something that sometimes people argue about. In Dokusan, you can't love without attachment. They're the same. I say, no, check it out. Observe, watch. The love that is not feverish because it's free of passions. There goes country music. Right? And a whole bunch of other good stuff, right? So free of the passions means to be in a fever, in a sense, kind of sick with overwhelming emotions. So it's a love that's free of that. It's not without emotion. It's not without feeling, not by a long shot, but it's not sick with the attachment of passion, of negative emotions. It's a love that accords with reality because it's equanimous in the three times. Think of skillful means. It's in accord with reality to see the person, ourself, the situation, the illness as it is, right? Not as we want it to be, not as it should be, but as it is. And this is just a stark, principle of Buddhism. Stark because so often we don't want it to be that. And we can be so invested in it not being that. And there can be the sense that if I accept that this is the reality, isn't that being complicit somehow? Or being defeated or being complacent? Rather, it's our attachment that binds us from actually seeing it clearly and responding without in a way that is more clear. To be skillful, to be in accord with reality means to bring forth compassion that recognizes that the person before us has Buddha nature. Sometimes it's very hard to see that. And in fact, you can't see Buddha nature. It's not a thing, right? If it was like a gas tank, you know, and you look at their meter, oh, they're full up, right? Oh my God, they're running on fumes, right? I don't know. Ridiculous. But we can't see it. So sometimes what seems to take over is their bad acting. And by bad, I mean horrible, evil, unconscionable. We have that capacity. And so to see their nature, because again, think about why is realizing the true nature of self and others at realizing emptiness. Why is that liberating? Because to the degree that I do not understand that, understand it conceptually, have faith in it, in practicing to live that, embody it, realize that, then I will see things. My overwhelming inclination will be to see things as fixed and solid and having their own power, and imputing a behavior or view into the person, that's who they are. And then we know what happens next. When we do that within ourselves, then what we experience can become seem intractable. Because it feels permanent, it feels fixed, it feels like me. And so in every way, with every step in which that is relaxing, softening, being seen more clearly, we will see that there will be a change. And then there will be moments and situations in which these old patterns come back with a vengeance, and we're right back in it. And so that element of mindfulness, which is to remember what you know. Remember the teachings, remember what you have experienced, remember what you have had faith in, remember how to practice this. It is a love that is without conflict, free of the violence of the passions. And so it is a compassion that is non-aggressive. Sometimes it is firm, it is forceful. But the point of that is not to hurt someone. You know, how many tyrants have been displaced by revolutionaries who became the next generation of tyrant? It's happened over and over and over and over. What makes us think that if the way I get there to my achieved goal, peace, is through hatred and violence and war, what makes me think I will know anything about peace when I get to that dreamt of goal? How will I know anything about peace if I'm not practicing, if I'm not examining, if I'm not cultivating, if I'm not being peace? It is love without deceit because it's genuine and not contrived. And it can be cultivated. So we can cultivate compassion when we feel absent, when you are running on fumes, right? You can't find it. Maybe you don't have it anymore. But you have practices. Can you speak? Yes, you can speak. Okay, can you do the four immeasurables? But I don't feel that. Okay, that's fine. Know that you don't feel. Know that you feel like your heart is hollow or filled with anger. And to the best of your ability, invoke those words with whatever measure of sincerity you can. There's nothing contrived about that. That's completely legitimate. That's actually a manifestation of compassion. May not feel like it. So don't rely on feelings all the time. It's a love that is giving because it gives with an open hand. It's not tight-fisted. It is love that is morally clear. So here he gets into the paramitas. Dana paramita is a form of compassion. It is morally clear, but because it improves the morality of others. How? You know, how does all this work when those that we want to help, we want to serve, we want to alleviate their suffering, they're not interested? They are actively not interested. They're not only not interested, but they're resentful, angry, and even the thought that you would want to, who are you? You know the story of the Buddha never disparaging in the Lotus Sutra. He pissed off a whole lot of bodhisattvas because he said, I will never disparage you. And that pissed them off. And they said, who are you to say that? And they would throw sticks and stones, and he would just back up beyond their reach. They were bodhisattvas. They probably couldn't throw very far. They're not out on the baseball field, you know? And then he would start up again. I will never disparage you. It is love that is patient and tolerant, protecting both self and others. And so that quality of not being afraid, which often means while you are afraid, while you have fear, while you're anxious, embody fearlessness. At the same time, that too is not contrived. Contrived is to pretend. There's no pretending going on. I see this. I am afraid. I am uncertain. I'm not sure what happens next. And I take a step based in my best sense, my understanding, my training, the degree to which I can see clearly, my experience. I draw on everything. That's why Kanon has 1,000 hands and arms. And so to improve the morality of others sometimes just simply means to do the best you can to be that very thing that is needed, that is called for. And it's easy to underestimate that. It's easy to think, You know, because we want results. Who doesn't want results? And it's not that the bodhisattva is just going out with a heart full of good intention, no skill whatsoever. You know, just throwing a deck of cards in the air and hoping something good happens. No, it's smart. It's intelligent. It's developing skills. But it's not attached to a goal. It does, there is an aspiration. It's a clear aspiration. There is a desire for this to stop, to shift, for another possibility to show itself. But if we attach to that, then in the presence of what seems like an impossible task, who will keep going? It's one of the most challenging things I think about compassion, is to practice the limitless body within a limitless universe. That's emptiness, that's selflessness, and bring that forth in a world that's limited, which our actions are limited, but not as much as we think. We just don't know. When you do something, give something, say something, you don't know what happens. I mean, you may see something, but you don't know what happens next. And then after that, and then after that, and then after that. And so to be living the life of a bodhisattva and alleviating suffering is to be an example, not self-conscious, not look at me, look at what I'm doing. That's not the mind of a bodhisattva. You're just living your vows. You're just doing your practice. A love that is patient and tolerant, protecting both self and others. Right? Because we know that if I meet intolerance with intolerance, how's that going to work out? The Buddha said, hatred is never appeased by hatred. Not ultimately. And this is an ultimate path. This is not just trying to get things, you know, just mitigate a little bit today. It's really, we're aspiring for something much greater than that. The love that is joyful because we're able and willing to take responsibility for ourselves and others. The love that is meditative because it neither denies nor grasps. Sound familiar? Those two basic impulses. I don't like this, deny. I like this, I grasp. So it's a compassion that is generating a meditation that is not perpetuating those. A love that is wisdom because it is always timely. It's in accord with time and place, position, degree, to the best of our ability. Love that is giving. You know, I think the trap of the dualistic mind is strong. You know, that if I'm not attached to the goal, then I don't care. If I apply myself and I'm not getting the results that I can see and measure, then it's not working. Why am I wasting my time? But if that was actually how anybody in this room thought, you wouldn't be here, right? Have any of you not had a moment where you thought, nothing's happening? I'm applying all this effort, nothing's going anywhere? I've told the story of when I went in to Dokusan once with Daroshi, very frustrated, discouraged. And this is after a while, you know. I'd been here and I moaned and groaned and, you know, I'm not getting anywhere, you know. And before, you know, he would encourage me, you know. And this time he went, oh, that's tough. He basically agreed with me by not arguing with me, which of course is what I wanted. So then I argue with myself. No, I'm not getting anywhere. I am getting somewhere. That's what I did when I came back to my cushion. How dare he think that I'm not getting? Of course I'm making. No, I'm not wasting my time. It was perfect. He didn't have to do a thing. You know, compassion is, to hear these teachings can be very soothing and comforting and inspiring. Compassion's tough in a world that is hard. And nobody said that life was without difficulty. Certainly not the Buddha, certainly not Buddhism. Kind of the contrary. It's sort of like, you know, the Bodhisattva is right there when you're born and says, okay, it's going to be hard. There's going to be a lot of amazing, incredible stuff. But don't be surprised when it's hard. Don't think it should not be hard. And that when it's hard, something is wrong. And whether hard is you, whether hard is a society, a time, we might just crawl back in, you know. That's why we wait until you get here. Too late. And that's why it's so important to face this as a Sangha. And not just as a Sangha, but there are a whole heap of people, a whole mess of people, all over the world, I would say more than most, more than not, who just want a fair shot at a life. They don't need to be an oligarch. They don't need to be in control of everything. They just want a decent shot at a life. And in the conditions in which that, I really believe that most people will want that for other people too. When things get scarce, we cling, we grasp. It's a survival mechanism. It's very hard to counter that. That's why this practice of generosity, practice of loving your enemy, of bringing forth compassion to those that are difficult, is so profound. And so as we are in our last hours of this Sangha, let's really appreciate, I appreciate the gift of this, these teachings, these practices, that we have refuge. Let's let Shantideva have the last word. May we never be separated from bodhicitta, and always follow the Bodhisattva's way of life. May we be cared for by the Buddhas and spiritual guides and forsake all deluded activity. In all temples and Dharma centers, may recitation and meditation flourish forever. May the Sangha always be in harmony, and may their wish to benefit others be fulfilled. May Sangha who wish to practice purely find the right conditions to do so, and abandoning all distractions, meditate with mental suppleness. I prostrate to Manjushri, through whose kindness my virtuous intentions arise, and I prostrate to my spiritual guides, through whose kindness my virtuous qualities increase.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.